This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. A traveling exhibition exploring the biodiversity of the Gulf of Mexico and the ecological issues it faces is now on display at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College here in Fort Myers. The traveling collection is titled Drifting Cabinets and blends art and science for an experience that includes biological specimens, illustrations, art, videos, scientific instruments, books, artifacts, and music from a variety of contributing artists and scientists. The exhibition culminates tonight with lectures from two of the exhibition's internationally renowned contributing artists who are joining us in studio today. Chip Lord, who is co-founder of the architecture media art collective Ant Farm, is with us. Lord's work is known for crossing experimental and documentary boundaries and includes video photography and installation work. His work has been included in collections at prestigious institutions all over the world, and he's professor emeritus at the department in the Department of Film and Digital Media at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Tonight's event at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery will also include a screening of his work, Miami Beach Elegy, which serves as a type of visual poem exploring the massive investment required to keep the city of Miami above water. Chip Lord, it's a pleasure to have you in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're also joined in studio today by Florida-based artist and curator Sean Miller. He's the founder and director of the John Erickson Museum of Art. Miller is professor at the University of Florida's School of Art and Art History. His work has received international acclaim as well. And Miller's work explores and questions practices related to existing power structures in contemporary art and politics. Sean Miller, thanks for taking the time to be with us today as well.
Thanks, John.
And we're joined by the director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, Jade Dellinger. Always great to speak with you, Jade. Thanks.
Thank you.
And as always, listeners can join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Get in touch with us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And first of all, this pop-up exhibition, as I mentioned, involves the collaboration of a number of artists and scientists. But how did the concept initially come about? Is there one person we could point to as the brainchild?
The project started originally as being the Crude Life Biodiversity Museum and working with Brandon Ballingy, who contacted me because I was doing the John Erickson Museum project and he was doing a show at the Armory. And we just started talking, and eventually he said he was going to be applying for a NAFCI Keck Futures Initiative grant for the National Academy of Sciences. And so we started collaborating together on kind of creating this identity for this portable biodiversity museum. And that toured around Louisiana, and I used the stipend money I got from it to prepare. The idea was that we were going to have two of these in Florida and in Louisiana. And so I used the money from the stipend to also create the other set of trunks for Florida. And then Brandon had a whole bunch of other projects going, and he said, I can't be touring through Florida next year, so just go for it. And so Drifting Cabinets is Florida, Crude Life is Louisiana. And
got you. You know, based on the title there, can we safely assume that this is, you know, somehow related to impacts of the BP oil spill in 2010?
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a whole component for the grant at LSU. He's doing a postdoc to study the effects of the oil spill, and this was like the outreach component was the portable museum.
Interesting, because just, you know, between the 2010 BP oil spill nearly a decade ago now and now here in Southwest Florida, of course, we've been experiencing this, you know, prolonged toxic red tide algae outbreak. Of course, it's been devastating to marine life and, of course, you know, the local economy of coastal communities all along the Gulf Coast here. And I noticed most of the places that this exhibit is going to are also, you know, along the coast or close enough to it that I think audiences that come to see this are going to be particularly impacted by it just because it's something that's always on the forefront of our minds. It's on the lips of just about every politician with Florida State Legislative Session coming up and water quality being such a huge issue. I have to imagine that's sort of part of why you chose some of the venues you did.
Yeah, and also the venues that have been chosen so far have just been – it's like been the path of least resistance. It's just getting the word out about it and people have invited. But it's designed to be – it can be shown as a prolonged exhibition, but it's in these old steamer trunks that are really beat up on the outside in a quite beautiful way, I think. And it allows for them to be transported around easily and to be open up quickly. The whole thing with the design is that that has to be able to be put up in an hour, and there's multiple trunks and light, they're self-lit, and the interiors are retrofitted and everything. So it has to be something that can be done quickly, and you can reach a lot of different audiences that way. It's not just one standard population that sees the exhibition. You can show up at we've done it at breweries or shrimp festivals or different things like that. So it's not the one audience that's seeing them, and that really allows for a rich dialogue with a lot of different people.
Was the Crude exhibition also kind of displayed this way with the trunk concept?
Exactly. Yeah. The trunks have been with it from the beginning. When it first started, we were talking, and I said, "Well, I can make all the displays into new trunks out of wood." And Brandon had a big quantity of them that he could get easily. And so I was just like, "Yeah, sure, we'll just." So, and it's really nice because for us, the way it worked out was the interiors are really polished, nice wood, and the exteriors are really and like lighting and everything, and the exteriors are really old looking. And so when my students tease me whenever they see me leaving with the trailer for the exhibition, because they say it looks like you're returning Tom Waits furniture or Tom Waits luggage or something. I like that too about it, is that it promotes curiosity even before it opens. When people see it pull up, it's like, well, what are all those? What's going to happen? You know, so it's nice.
Yeah, interesting that aside from, you know, just their functionality in terms of portability, that they're really a part of the exhibit itself too.
Right, right. Oh. And the wood for the interiors are all from trees that have been downed by Hurricane Irma or Michael. And the wood especially, I mill it and make sure it gets dried and ready, and then do the woodworking displays with all that stuff. So it's like literally the climate change is like a part of the physicality of the museum.
Wow, layers upon layers there. Well, give us something of a primer of what folks who come to experience this can expect. I mean, I mentioned there's going to be biological specimens. And I have to say from photos I've seen of this up at previous venues, it's going to be hard for me to not – I'm going to have to walk around with my hands in my pockets because I'm going to want to touch everything. Is that going to be part of at least part of the experience? Is it supposed to be tactile, or am I supposed to keep my hands to myself?
Yeah, it's definitely meant to be
– okay, good.
To be interacted with. There's two microscopes, and you know, in the case of Louisiana, there was in some of the classes, the kids don't really have never had that experience before. So it does a lot for just science outreach in general, or just kind of teaching people about how science works, and people can pick up all the specimens and look at them. And
all right. And I guess, you know, we were talking about kind of the connections between the three of you over the years just as artists. And I'm wondering how you connected with the scientists who were involved in this, because it kind of seems like they would move in sort of different academic circles.
Oh, well, there's the NAFKE grant. It brings together artists and scientists, like that's a part of what it does. But then also working at UF, it's like a Research One school. And then also I teach art science classes at UF and things like that. So there's like the local Ashton Biological Preserve or the Luby Bat Conservancy that are all in Gainesville. I just connect with those people naturally through wanting to get the students to meet with them as well. And once you meet a few of the scientists, everybody, you start meeting all these other people and form relationships. And like the entomology department, Lisa Ann Taylor often donates the insects for the exhibitions and things like that. So there's just a lot of different scientists. And the scientists are up for it as much as the artists. It's really exciting time that way, that there's a lot of people. They have outreach that they have to do for their labs, but then artists do socially engaged work, and a lot of the times you're trying to get funding for projects, and it's just natural to work together now, which is really great.
Would it be safe to assume that, you know, the majority of the biological specimens included in the exhibition were contributed by the scientists?
No, not completely.
Oh, okay.
I collect some of them, and I also cast some of the specimens from the Florida Museum of Natural History, and so because they don't want to have the thing out on permanent loan. But like I have a vertebrae from a whale that died in the oil spill that I cast, so I just borrowed it and did alginate cast. It's a real team effort, you know.
Do you consider the exhibition in some way to be a call to action regarding environmental conservation and restoration?
Yeah, definitely, but not. An open-ended one that is more about curiosity and sparking dialogue than it is being didactic towards a certain kind of behavior or something like that. Because I think the problem is more complex, and I think it's better just to. I think one great thing about it is when you have scientists and artists together, just not framed by an institution, talking with people at a shrimp festival, and you know that takes away a lot of the political charge of it. It's just people, you know, talking together, and really amazing conversations happen that way.
So more of a call to awareness and to dialogue,
right,
which would eventually probably spark some action.
Hopefully,
yes.
Yeah,
Well, and Chip Lord, we're going to delve deeper into your background and previous video works in a bit. But first, tell me about your Miami Beach Elegy that's going to be screened tonight as part of the exhibition here locally. This is a visual poem.
It's a visual poem, and it's not a documentary. It's a kind of observed portrait of Miami Beach in the beginning of the 21st century. We're not in the beginning anymore, but and because you know, it may not be there by the end of the century. So, and I actually took a cue from Elizabeth Colbert's book, which is she's a journalist who writes about science. And in describing how biologists were working in Panama to make a record of a Panamanian tree frog that's going extinct, she used the phrase, they're recording how it was, so there'll be a record of what was here after it's gone. And I love that phrase, and that's kind of what I did with Miami Beach.
It's interesting to think about because when you look at Miami Beach now and you know, the skyscrapers and all the infrastructure that is there, it can almost seem like impossible. Like how could in such a short span of time this actually be so threatened? But I mean, we're already reaching the point now where when natural occurrences like king tides happen there, I mean, you just experience flooding. The stormwater systems can't handle it. I mean, it's happening in front of our eyes.
Yeah. The other thing that drew me to Miami Beach was reading an article about how the mayor had campaigned on a promise to solve the problem of the flooded streets, you know. And that just seemed like such a Band-Aid in terms of the scale of climate change and what's coming behind it. So I wanted to go down and investigate that idea. And, you know, it's funny, though. They have sort of – created a short-term solution by pumping the water back out into Biscayne Bay, but only during high tide. If you pump during high tide, you can probably then, before it comes back in, you've got a clear street. That was just the kind of really a good example of short-term thinking, I thought. And, of course, politicians love short-term solutions and are less ambitious about taking on long-term problems.
Are those pumps part of what I saw in the trailer for the film?
Yes.
Okay.
That was what you were seeing there was a stopgap measure of pumping using portable pumps before they were doing the infrastructure change, which required actually going into the storm drains and creating, a baffle that would not allow the water to come back up. It has to be a one-way storm drain to the bay, and then also pumping stations to pump it out.
Gotcha. Yeah. And if you want to, if any of our listeners want to see that trailer, we've got a link to it on our website. If you go to the post about today's show, and of course, if you want to see a screening of the whole thing, you'll need to come out to the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery this evening. We're speaking with two of the internationally renowned artists behind the pop-up exhibition Drifting Cabinets, now at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery. Chip Lord and Sean Miller, along with Rauschenberg Gallery Director Jade Dellinger, are with us. And reminder, listeners can join our conversation. Bring your questions and comments into the conversation. Call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Chip Lord, both of you, it's not often I get to speak with artists with, you know, such a rich history as yourselves. So I kind of wanted to delve into some of your past works that maybe aren't directly related to what's going on with Drifting Cabinets. And Chip Lord, I understand your initial interest in architecture, because that's where your formal education is. Mm-hmm. It was sparked by like a boyhood passion of exploring homes under construction. Having grown up in a neighborhood that was developing myself, I can certainly relate to that experience, walking around houses that were half finished and realizing I've never considered what's behind the drywall.
Yeah. I lived in St. Pete. We moved when I was 11 to St. Pete, and so I think there were more opportunities to do that in Florida than there were in Connecticut. But that was sort of the initial. I still think, you know, buildings often look more beautiful while they're under construction than they do finished. But that's probably why I ended up more in the realm of art than architecture.
Yeah, tell me about that, because as I understand, you sort of came to know before you even graduated that you weren't going to go down that typical road of, you know, joining an architecture firm. I guess what prompted you to study architecture but then go into art?
You know, there were so many outside influences. I was in architecture at Tulane during the 1960s. And, you know, one prime influence was Andy Warhol, painter who then started making films. And I was also interested in media. I remember when Marshall McLuhan's book, The Medium is the Massage, came out. It was a collaboration with a graphic designer, and McLuhan, an English professor, really was, you know, had forward thinking in terms of, in some sense, where we are now in terms of media. But I did complete my degree, but the other influence, of course, was the counterculture movement. You know, during the 60s, of course, the civil rights movement, then the anti-war movement against Vietnam, and then that became a student movement. And so when I graduated in 1968, and of course Martin Luther King had been assassinated, Robert Kennedy had just been assassinated, you know, it was a tumultuous time. And I would say, you know, a lot of young architecture graduates didn't want to go into the corporate structure because of the influence of the idea there was a counterculture emerging, you know, that would be a youthful counterculture. And I went to San Francisco to attend a workshop given by Larry Halperin, the landscape architect, and his wife, Ann Halperin, a dancer. And it was for architects and dancers, which was great, you know.
Yeah. Interesting combination.
Yeah. And then a guy I had met, Doug Michaels, joined me in San Francisco. He was also a recent graduate of architecture. He went to Yale. And so because we decided we're going to create an alternative or an underground architectural practice. So it wasn't consciously leaving the architectural field, but what would be an underground architectural practice? And I think some of the first experiments were with lightweight structures using Army surplus cargo parachutes as a form of architecture. We were teaching at the University of Houston in the spring of 1969, and we did workshops with students where we would go down to the beach at Freeport, Texas. And then gradually the parachutes were replaced by inflatable structures that were single membrane couldn't heat them. but they were transportable. They were nomadic. They were lightweight. They were ephemeral. And it just was symbolically the opposite of the architecture we had studied in the 60s.
So that would have primarily been, you know, brutalism, which as I understand it was really just
right.
about above all functionality over aesthetic. And so you kind of took that in the opposite direction?
Yeah, I think brutalism really was in part functionality, but also there was a strong aesthetic component to – and really a kind of sculpting in concrete with, you know, brutalist materials but making it into an art form in a way that was maybe in a sense never admitted by most of the practitioners, the architects that did it.
I kind of find it remarkable that you and Doug Michaels both came from an architecture background educationally, because I can't imagine that a rigorous academic program in architecture would leave much room for you to even really take classes in liberal arts.
That's exactly true. And I've always regretted since that I didn't get any college courses in geography or psychology or history. So, you know, in some ways I'm not that well trained in the humanities. I've tried to make up for that in the years since. But, you know, once we started this underground practice, there weren't a lot of clients knocking on the door. So we basically had to invent the projects ourselves. And some of those were architectural. But I think the influence of the Halpern Workshop led us into the idea of performance as a communicative medium. And so there were a number of performances that were combined with the inflatable structures. And some of those went in the direction of an environmental content. One was called the Clean Air Pod. It was an inflatable. But we were invited on the first Earth Day in 1970 to the University of California at Berkeley. And we came with this inflatable, but we would announce with a megaphone, it's an air emergency, everybody inside the Clean Air Pod. Because, you know, the sky over the Bay Area then was literally brown. It was very smoggy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the counterculture had an association with the environmental movement, and that was and actually tonight in my brief lecture before showing Miami Beach Elegy, I'm going to touch on several projects that Ant Farm did related to environmental protest.
Excellent, excellent. And there was a little bit of a I think a humorous I think result of that, you know, air emergency, because there was also the road flares that were involved. I had heard that at one of the performances, by the time it was over, everybody had to clear out because of the fumes from
That's right. And that performance was called Gas Station. It was done actually in a classroom.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't an outdoor performance. And but the members of Ant Farm, I was one of them, we put on gas masks. And we had a road warning flare, and we had a cake that was decorated to look like a spare tire. And we put the flare in the cake and lit it. And the room was full of students, from USC students. And then we turned the lights down. We just projected slides of gas stations on the wall. There may be an Ed Ruscha influence there. I'm not sure. But that was it. And the duration of the piece was how long it took for the highway flare to burn down and go out. And when we turned the lights back up, the room was empty. Which was kind of the point, you know.
Well, going back to the performance piece you talked about, where you were like, it's an air emergency, everyone in the clean air tent. Now, did people know that they were participating in an art event, or do you think they really thought, oh, the smoggy air isn't safe?
I don't think they thought it was – I mean, I think they could see the smog, but they probably didn't – they could probably also realize that there wasn't any sophisticated technology involved in cleaning that air.
Gotcha.
It was a theater piece in a way. But they were happy to participate because, you know, they got to experience being in the inflatable. And we wore white lab coats that gave us some authority to.
Okay. Well, moving forward a bit, I know growing up in the 50s kind of helped spark your interest in changing designs of Cadillac cars over the years, particularly how those tail fins changed. And, of course, that we see prominently displayed visually in Cadillac Ranch. And that installation, I understand, is still remaining in Texas. Introduce us to the concept behind Cadillac Ranch and maybe tell us a bit about how it's changed over the years. When was the last time you were there? Sorry, that was like five questions.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, the one thing that I shared with Doug and with also Hudson Marquez, the other Ant Farm partner, was growing up in the 1950s and just being complete car nuts and, you know, looking forward to the introduction of the new cars. And the tail fin was the most striking stylistic accoutrement. And the tail fins grew until 1959. They peaked on the Cadillac. The Cadillac was the top of the line for General Motors, and it was their slogan was the standard of the world. And so we had shared that experience and given the opportunity in 1973, I guess, to we were invited to make a proposal by a rich Texas millionaire who lived in Amarillo. And we proposed doing a diagram, a literal three-dimensional diagram of the rise and fall of the Cadillac tail fin. 10 cars from 1948 to 1964, when the tail fin is only a vestigial addition to the rear fender. And, you know, it was 1974, so it was that the oldest model was only 10 years old at that point, and we were able to source in the Texas Panhandle these 10 cars pretty easily over a course of several weeks and put them in the ground in the course of 5 days, you know, using a backhoe. And so it was inaugurated on the summer solstice, 1974. We've had anniversary parties in 84, 94, and 2004. And during that time period, it's always been a public work on a privately owned property. So the public has interacted with it, and first by scratching their initials into the paint, and eventually, of course, spray cans arrived, spray paint arrived. And now, in some places, the paint is so thick, you know, you can peel it off. It's like an inch thick. It has that many layers of paint.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was there I was there last October. Been there a couple of times in the last couple of years, and I made a video called "Greetings from Amarillo," which is not about Cadillac Ranch, but coincidentally begins and ends at Cadillac Ranch. The last time I was there, Stanley Marsh has passed away. His son and his daughter run the business, which is a land-owning company. And they told me that the Amarillo Tourist Bureau had done a census, and they had calculated that more than a million people stop every year at Cadillac Ranch. So they have a real problem, which is, traffic problem, parking problems.
Well, because people just – they have to park on the side of the road and actually walk up to it.
That's right, on the access road. And that, I think, is one of the best decisions we made was the distance we placed it from the highway so that you have to have that experience of walking out there. And the course of approaching it, by the time you get there, you're looking at a sculpture, not a car, you know, not any one given car. So and then it's been in publicized a lot, and it took us years to sort of establish the copyright with people, you know, because there's no signage. The original idea would be no signage. It'll be an interesting experience for people to discover, but that led to all sorts of unauthorized uses, which we would have to sort of track down and try to shake down if, you know, the company that was using it to advertise. And but now it gets licensed occasionally. And then the most recent one was last summer, a luxury fashion studio in Stockholm, Acne Studios, shot a photo session there with Cindy Crawford to introduce the, you know, the fall line of their luxury products.
That's not the first time it's been used in such a photo shoot either.
That's right. Yeah.
Also, though, I know it's been used or it had been in the past by like mass media organizations. They would take pictures of it. I mean, because – I mean, yes, it's sculpture, but literally it's these classic Cadillacs buried like half in the earth. And so it was used representationally as like the decline of the American auto industry. Does it bother you that it was used in such a way, or do you kind of see that as, you know, that's the interpretation that anybody can bring to any piece of art?
Yeah, you know, I like to quote Damian Ortega, the Mexican artist who did a work that is also a ready-made in a sense. And his work is called Cosmic Thing, in which he used a Volkswagen Beetle, which he exploded it. You know, he literally took it apart and hung all the parts up. It's just a literal – it's a diagram from a technical manual made three-dimensional. But in I read an interview with Damian, and he said I think the work itself is smarter than the artist, and I like that idea. And I could say that about Cadillac Ranch too.
All right.
You know, it has its own life. It's already outlived, you know, Doug Michaels, and it will probably outlive all of the creators of the work.
Well, I'm moving maybe back a little bit. One of my favorite performance pieces from Ant Farm was Media Burn. And, you know, I saw an initial design sketch from 1973, but the actual performance didn't occur until a few years after that, right?
75,
July 4th, 1975. Okay. And so, I mean, just to quickly sum it up, the actual performance involved driving a vehicle that had been, you know, specially converted for this purpose into a tower of televisions.
That's right.
Quite dramatic. And, you know, media was there. There were hundreds of folks who were there to witness this happening. And you even had a – I don't know if he was officially an actor or a member of the Ant Farm Collective, but someone who was like a president artist serving as like a politician giving a speech before the event. And we had a quick audio clip of that, and I wanted to play that now.
Thank you very much. Distinguished guests, members of the press, my fellow Americans, on this Independence Day, 1975, the American spirit is uncertain. We have seen in this decade an unworthy war. We have seen political scandal. Now we are seeing economic turmoil. From these has come not only the dangerous condition of our country, but a pervasive doubt of our ability to correct it. I believe we can find solutions in our origins. What has gone wrong with America is not a random visitation of fate. It is the result of forces which have assumed control of the American system. Economic royalists, as oppressive as a crown 200 years ago. These forces are militarism, monopoly, and the mass media. And so, my fellow Americans, let me say this finally about Media Burn. The world may never understand what was done here today, but the image created here shall never be forgotten. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
was audio from 1975 from Media Burn, which, of course, was an art performance piece from the architecture arts collective Ant Farm. And of course, we're speaking with one of the founding members of Ant Farm with us, Chip Lord, today. Listening to that more than 40 years ago, it's a little chilling just because it seems like that could have been written last week.
Yeah. Still relevant. That speech was adapted, or we used as a template, a piece that George McGovern had written for Rolling Stone magazine. It was his State of the Union 2 years after he had been defeated by Nixon for the presidency. And that's where the structure of the speech came from. So it should be credited. We had to change, I forget what we changed, militarism, monopoly, but we had to make the third one, the mass media. Mm-hmm. That was a key change that we made. And, we'd chosen the date July 4th because it's a slow news day. So we thought if we can get the local TV stations out to cover this event, they'll surely have to run it. So we wrote a press release and sent it to all the local stations, and we had press passes that we designed and made, and we included a couple press passes, and they all showed up wearing their press passes. We had created a zone that only the press could get into, more dangerous than what the public spectators, they had to be held back for their own safety, and we had rental cops to enforce those rules. We didn't really realize the degree to which the local news commentators would, of course they would react in a predictable way, but how that would add a kind of ironic twist in the videotape of Media Burn.
Yeah. And of course, with it serving as a sort of, raising of awareness or criticism of some of the systems we have in place here. And I think there's some great parallels, Sean Miller, between that and between your work. And I'll get into that in a moment. But I was thinking a lot about this and sort of the conditions that would have been criticizing, because, at that time with mass media, when it came to broadcast television, you just had the three major networks.
That's right.
But since then, so much has changed. We've seen the advent of the 24-hour cable news network, and then, of course, with the internet, it's almost like it's created the ability for people to be able to curate their own media experience. But we're still facing maybe a lot of the same problems. And I'm wondering if your art maybe – if that's changed over time to reflect how, media might change, but we still fundamentally still have some of the same issues we did back then.
I think that's true. But, I think all we could do is kind of point to it at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
We were associated with a network of video guerrillas guerrilla video makers, and there was a more nuanced, let's say, critique of the media situation. And at that time, there was the hope that cable television and public access would allow people to make their own TV. So now we have hundreds of channels, but it's harder as ever to find the public access channel or be inspired by it, I guess. But I think, I eventually, after Ant Farm, worked in video for most of the rest of my career. First, I was hired as a video artist to teach where they wanted to add video to the curriculum in a visual arts department. And even though the title video artist seems kind of irrelevant today, since everybody has a video camera in their pocket.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Let's talk about some of those video projects, because I know over the last 10 years or so, that's kind of involved peak air travel. First of all, there was the photo series of self-portraits where you're kind of dressed like an executive traveling through an airport, and then the to and from LAX video project from 2010 to 2014, and then how that kind of morphed when you went to Buenos Aires as part of the biennial on the moving image, reconfiguring that into from LAX to and from 2.0.
Yeah. You have really done your homework, I have to say.
Well, I blame you. If a subject's interesting, I'll just clicking the next link. So, is that still what you're working on today, that type of work?
Yeah, although the project about airports, I mean, I did the executive air travel traveler project in the early 80s, and that for me was about establishing an identity after Ant Farm, after working collectively in a group for 10 years. But then I came back to it because I realized, I don't know at what point, the turn of the century, I guess in the 21st century, that airports were always being remodeled. So, you know, it should be an ongoing documentation project to just record the experience of moving through those spaces, which are, you know, could be considered non-spaces. You know, some people have theorized that they are non-spaces. But if you think about it, how many people are in the air at any given moment? It's a good-sized city of people who are traveling, and they're either coming or going. So to and from LAX, the last time I showed it was in a project called the Museum of Capitalism, an exhibition in Oakland. And there I retitled it To and From LAX, Peak Air Travel 2.0, because I think, you know, we have to look at these patterns of consumption and the price they pay in terms of putting carbon into the atmosphere, basically, and CO2 into the atmosphere. And I don't think the present scale of air travel is a sustainable practice. And so that's one kind of subtext of that work, I think. It's not an overt documentary project that spells that out. But I've turned to reading about science and looking at climate change and realizing this is the most important subject that anybody as an artist or anybody really can deal with at this point in time. It's so important to for young people to realize that especially. And, you know, my daughter is 37. One of her best friends just had a baby, and that baby's going to live to the end of the 21st century. And thinking about what the conditions will be at the end of the century are, you know, pretty problematic, I think.
Yeah, I don't mean to derail the sustainability aspect of it, but just wanted to ask briefly if that project also interested you, just in terms, you know, with your background in architecture, just the airports themselves structurally.
Yes.
And then I don't know if this is still the case today, but I'm thinking, like, in particular of airports like Dulles International. I mean, there is such artistry in the architecture.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been in some sense a golden age of airport design. The terminal in Beijing, Norman Foster designed that one, I think. There's a Madrid Terminal 4, I think it is, in London. These are really beautiful buildings and massive projects too. And you know, it's an infrastructure that will be someday relics of. Yeah. Our culture.
Yeah. And Sean Miller, how did you connect with Chip as it relates to the Drifting Cabinets project?
I first got to know Chip because I invited him to come to University of Florida as a visiting artist. And then as a result of that, kept in touch. And there's been other connections. One of our student projects became an inflatable project at UF, where they create the inflatable sculptures, and so that was and having him come as a visiting artist, I could show him that. But I've been a fan of Ant Farm for a long time, and I got their video compilation of all their stuff, and Curtis Schreier is explaining how to do it, and it still works today. Like, I was sitting there watching it and thinking, this would be great for our freshmen to do. And because it's got everything you need in tinfoil, plastic, and an iron. And Curtis explains eloquently how to do it in old yeah. VHS tape, and it was a beautiful thing to watch. And so, so the students do that, and so I send pictures of the inflatables sometimes to Chip, and that's been kind of fun. So there's a few different connections, and also this kind of way of working in an interventionist way in the public realm that also I think relates to the spirit of John Eric's Museum of Art and Drifting Cabinets.
Yeah, I was going to say it seems like that's completely linked with the mission of you know, the GEMA, which you founded. Can you talk to us more, I guess, about the general concept behind that? Because it seems like you've really gone out of your way to curate, you know, pieces or collections that are provocative or really intended to get people to think about things differently and to challenge their worldviews and perspectives.
Right. After I got out of school, it was like I moved to Seattle with my girlfriend, and it was right after Kurt Cobain had died, and we were moving there because that's where we knew all these artists were moving to. Everybody was moving to Seattle for some reason at that time, and so we started a collective called Soil there that involved a lot of experimental. And the reason we started it is because we got there and we thought, well, there's so much stuff going on with music, and it seemed like a new kind of counterculture. But when we got there, we realized for visual arts, like, we want to do installation performance and kind of interventionist things. And it didn't really have that opportunity. So we had to make our own kind of art scene that it supported that. And so we started a space right across the street from the Seattle Art Museum in a building that was supposed to be knocked down. And I was working at the Seattle Art Museum and the King County Arts Commission and some other things. And so that led into the thinking about John Erickson Museum, because we realized we were working. Everybody we knew that was involved with the project had multiple jobs. Like, sometimes you're a curator, sometimes you're an exhibiting artist, sometimes you were a museum employee, and all these things mixed together. It gave me a kind of a happily cynical view of contemporary art. Because I was seeing it from all angles at once, and I realized there's a level of absurdity to it, and there's also some things that are incredibly important about it. And that all fed into my idea about the John Erickson Museum of Art. And the name comes from the fact that if you go to Seattle today and you go to the Seattle Art Museum, the land that the Seattle Art Museum is on is occupying where an old building used to be called the Arcade Building. And that's where my great-grandfather had a watchmaking and engraving and jewelry store. He was kind of a painter and did a lot of stuff. And so I figured out – I was working at the Seattle Art Museum as an art prep, and I started realizing – I found out exactly where his shop was facing out over 2nd Avenue. And I, after I left the Seattle Art Museum and started teaching here in Florida, this is when I started the John Erickson Museum, and I got some blueprints from people I knew that were still working there that they probably would have gotten in trouble if they got them for me, and I just recreated the room that corresponded to where my great grandfather's building, their arcade building, would have been, and I started it, so I made it a 1/4 inch to a foot scale. And it fits into an aluminum carrying case that actually fits into the overhead bins and planes. And so it's really and just kind of made it as realistic as possible and took really close-up photographs of it. And a lot of times when I invite artists to do exhibitions, I don't tell them it's a small – I don't emphasize the fact that the John Erickson Museum of Art is miniature. I just send them pictures of the gallery, and I send out press releases when I do shows. And as a result, I've sometimes confused the institution. Like when I had a show at the Contemporary in Baltimore, people were delivering things to the Contemporary, but we had put up so much John Erickson Museum of Art stuff around the entrance that when the UPS person came in, they actually turned around and started to leave.
They thought they were at the wrong place.
They thought they were at the John Erickson Museum, yeah. And so we had to call them to come back in, and you know. But and we do unsanctioned shows as well as being invited shows. So I've been like kicked out. I've shown in Art Basel with John Erickson Museum 1 year, and another year I got kicked out of Art Basel for having an opening for the John Erickson Museum. But it's always with real artists, like and actually, artists, I'm amazed at how generous people have been, because I don't make any money off the John Erickson Museum, and I don't offer money to the artists, but like some really exciting artists have been generous to do it. And the fun thing about it is the openings are scaled down proportional to the size, so the openings are only 2 minutes long. One of the strategies to try to figure out where the opening is going to occur, because it can happen anywhere. It can happen in an alley, or it could happen in a really exciting place. I've done openings at the Four Corners in the United States and had 2 minute openings in each state, and different things like that. So it puts the whole state of art into a state of play that's exciting, and that's directly related to, I think, also Ant Farm and Fluxus, which were some of the things that a lot of us that started Soil were thinking about. That kind of moving against culture, but still like trying to build culture up. You know, like taking out the stuff that's unimportant and just like bringing it directly to the people and seeing what happens. And creating confusing situations. Because I think the best art moments in museums or any kind of art context happens when people are a little bit confused and things aren't being explained to them, you know?
Yeah. So. And Jay Dellinger, director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, I don't think I've asked you a question yet, and I hope you've just been enjoying listening. But what made you want to bring this here specifically? Cabinets.
Sure. Well, of course, you know, we did a retrospective of John Erickson Museum of Art in 2014, and Chip Lord, I have always been he's been a hero to me too. So this idea, of course, staying in contact and being very connected with Sean, you know, as soon as I learned about this project, I thought we absolutely needed to find a way to bring it and when to bring it. And of course, just as he's been describing, to do so as a sort of pop-up thing and in the context of the Gorilla Girls seemed to be fitting. So it's a one-day event. So everyone will need to kind of make their way over at some point this afternoon and then be there for the talk tonight, you know, from 6 to 7:30.
Excellent, excellent. And for those of us listeners out there who maybe missed our conversation a couple of weeks ago on the Gorilla Girls, you can go to the WGCU.org website and find that there. Interesting. I don't think I would have made that connection if you hadn't brought that up. And just tell me a little bit more about tonight's event. There's going to be a music element as well. You've got a Dan Stepp performing.
I think, you know, Dan has actually done some recordings and has often shown up in these pop-up environments and performed. He actually was involved. He was a security guard when we had the Gemma exhibition opening. He's not actually here today, but I think there may be his presence will resonate just in that also there is a new component to the whole project that that Sean could probably talk about that has to do with bringing together music and making a kind of soundtrack.
Yeah. Dan Stepp and Kevin Mahoney so far have been the people that are the performative kind of musical people involved with the project. And it's tied into this idea of a biodiversity Gulf of Mexico mixtape. And there's a sculptural suitcase that has a giant wooden cassette tape that I constructed, and it has information things that people can fill out and talk about music that and recording artists that they think should be a part of the mixtape. So, and for the younger audiences, it's good because you want these curious elements in it, and people, if you love something, you create a mixtape for it, so people can interact with that, and Dan will sing for you at a later date.
Oh, right. I can appreciate that. I still make mixed CDs, so yeah. I'm still behind the times there. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guests. We've been speaking with internationally renowned artists Sean Miller and Chip Lord. They'll be speaking at tonight's Art Speak at FSW event in conjunction with the pop-up exhibition Drifting Cabinets, now at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College. And I want to emphasize tonight's event is free. And a big thanks also to Bob Rauschenberg Gallery Director Jay Dellinger for taking the time to be with us and for bringing these great guests to me. I really appreciate it. Well, our show today was produced by yours truly, and our director today was Mike Canary. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.